This lecture is brought to you by Knox Theological Seminary on iTunes U. Knox is a seminary in the tradition of the Reformation that exists to educate men and women to declare and demonstrate the gospel of Jesus Christ. Our prayer is that this teaching will be beneficial in your Christian life and ministry.
What I want to talk about now is the way this all began. How did it start? Why did it start? What was the underlying purpose of it? Criticism, in the modern sense, really began in the 17th century. In other words, about 100 years after the time of Luther and Calvin. It wasn't in their time, it was later. And one of the reasons for this, and there were various factors, but one of them was that the Reformation had claimed, you see, that it was possible to reform the church, to remake the church on the basis of Scripture, that the Bible would give enough information, to be able to be adequate for the reformation of the church. 100 years on, Protestantism, unfortunately, as we know, had broken up into different, what we now call different denominations. And this was a problem. It was a problem because all of these different denominations believed that the Bible was the basis of their faith. But if you thought that, how are you going to apply it? Why do people disagree about this? What was the problem? I mean, how should the church be governed, for example? I mean, should the church be governed by a central organization of some kind, and each congregation recognized as a kind of branch of the center, so that individual congregations wouldn't have the power to appoint their own pastors or, to establish their own doctrine or anything like that? Or should the church be a collection of congregations, essentially sovereign congregations, who would move in and out of fellowship with each other, hopefully be in fellowship with each other, but not subordinate to one another? So that if, a congregation wanted to get rid of its pastor, that was its business. It could get rid of the pastor and appoint somebody else. And there was no central organization which, could either send a pastor, impose a pastor there, tell the local people, sorry, you can't do that. You can't get rid of the person. Now, these questions arose, of course, as we know today, because they're not clearly stated in the Bible. I mean, the New Testament does not give us adequate information for running the church. We just don't have enough there to go on. Now, we can recognize this today, but the problem was in the 17th century, people refused to believe that. You see, they could not imagine that God would not have given complete instructions in the New Testament. And so they claimed that the information was there. People who disagreed with whatever they thought about it were just simply wrong. And occasionally, of course, you still hear this today, for instance, over questions of baptism. I mean, should we baptize infants or not? Well, there's no clear case in the New Testament, of course, of a child being baptized. If there were, this wouldn't be a problem. However, as someone has pointed out, there's also no clear case in the New Testament of a woman being baptized. But they presumably were. I mean, the fact that it wasn't mentioned, as such, doesn't mean that it wasn't happening. You can't argue from that. And then, of course, you have the questions of the household baptisms and so on. Well, however you're going to resolve this question, nobody can claim, or nobody ought to claim, that the Bible is clear about on this subject. Either way, you know that there, it's not settled one way or the other by Scripture. But the Baptists, of course, and those who opposed them, both believed that it was. So they were arguing on the basis of Scripture, which didn't really come down on one side or the other, but they were making it do so. Now, in itself, this might not have been too much of a problem. I mean, this is just people sort of discussing one way or another. But you have to remember in the 17th century that the church, every country in Europe, every European country, had a state church. So if the church was, you know, divided over something or other, this was a political issue. And in some places, and notably in England, it led to civil war because the different groups just could not agree, you know, as the Puritans versus the Episcopalians and so on. I mean, they just could not agree as to how to run the church and what should be done about this. Now, when this kind of thing starts to happen, there are people, who are sitting around saying, you can't run a country like this. You know, we can't have a civil war every time somebody starts to argue about baptism or, you know, whether we should have elders or not. You know, I mean, these may be interesting or important questions, but if it's going to split the church, and if the church is splitting the church, is going to split the country. This happened in England in the 1630s. A small group of people got together at a place called Great Tew, T-E-W, just outside Oxford. And they sat down and they said, well, what alternative can we suggest? I mean, what, you know, if this isn't working, what other way of doing things is there? And the Great Tew Circle, as it was called, came up with the idea that reason should govern whether, you know, the rights or wrongs of something. If it, something made sense, if it was rational, then, you know, it should be accepted. And they said that the empirical discoveries of reason are really the only basis for doing anything, you know, one way or the other. Now, if something was not susceptible to reason, I mean, if there was no particular argument for it or against it, like baptism, for instance, then it shouldn't matter. You know, people should just be allowed to do what they want. I mean, not impose a particular order or discipline on everybody else. So this approach, rationalism, combined with what we today would call libertarianism, at the time was called latitudinarianism. That's the same thing, really. I mean, basically allowing people to, you know, to decide for themselves things that aren't really very important, or suggesting that if there's no rational conclusion to be drawn, if different possibilities exist, it doesn't really matter all that much. These people, this is what they were advocating. Now, the rest of society at the time, of course, was horrified by this. They thought, no, this is no good, because, of course, you're replacing God and divine revelation with human reason. And while today we have become accustomed to this, we're used to this, you've got to realize that in the 17th century, very few people thought like that. I mean, this is the time of Galileo. You see, when Galileo was coming up with his theories about, you know, the Earth revolving around the sun and this kind of thing. I mean, this was in Italy, of course, in the Roman Catholic Church. I mean, he was censured. He was put under house arrest and all kinds of other things because he was apparently going against the teaching of the church, the teaching of the Bible, because the sun stood still when Joshua went to battle and so on. And, you know, Galileo didn't believe that, so, you know, it's tough. You just get kicked out, and that's your problem, sort of thing. So people were suffering, you see, for what we would think of today as scientific analysis, scientific discovery. Well, although at the time these arguments were not, you know, widely circulated, there were enough growing number of people who began to think that something like this, there had to be an objective standard by which things could be measured. And it seemed that science, mathematics, these things, which were not matters of opinion, personal opinion, but, you know, could be demonstrated by experiment to be true or false one way or the other, that this should be the criterion by which everything else was judged. And gradually this view came to dominate the political life of Western European countries. They just couldn't afford to go on falling out over religious issues. You can only do that so long, but you can't go on and on forever. And so, in the course of the 17th century, this was tacitly, initially, and then openly agreed that different religious views would be tolerated one way or another, at least in different places. I mean, you might have to move house, move to another country to find the church of your choice, but you could do that one way or another. Basically common sense and reason would determine the way the government was to run. That was one thing. The other thing is how to deal with people who have different opinions and who aren't going to agree. The rational solution to this, and this was part of it, was to tolerate them. You see, if there's no clear answer to something, well, allow people with different opinions to coexist. Let there be open discussion, argument, debate, and so on. Maybe we'll come to some truth. Maybe we won't. Maybe we'll just have to say, well, you do that thing, and we'll do this thing, and we'll have to live in peace with each other, agree to disagree. And that there's really nothing wrong with this, because the things that we disagree about are not that fundamentally important. I mean, we may think they are ourselves personally, but they're not really in the overall pattern of society. So that was another idea that was going around. Then there were people who started to question Christian doctrine. And this began already in the time of Calvin. You can read it in Calvin's Institutes. Arguing that if the Bible is the source of our faith, source of truth, then things that are not in the Bible can't be imposed as doctrine. And of course, what they had in their sights above all was the doctrine of the Trinity. Because I said the Trinity is not in the Bible, at least not in that way, in that form. And so you can't insist on this, you see. It may be rational to believe in a God, to believe in a supreme being, a kind of, you know, ultimate reality in the universe. But you could never prove the doctrine of the Trinity by rational means. This was the origin of what we now call Unitarianism, you see, which came into prominence in the 17th century. Now, the difficulty with all this, of course, was that these people were not, on the whole, sectarians, there was some of that, but they were part of the establishment. They were, you know, they were prominent people who were respectable citizens. I mean, they didn't go off and start rebellions or anything like this. You know, not that kind of thing. And so it was very hard to know what to do with them. Now, the government, the English government in the late 17th century, one of the things they decided to try, at least, whether they would succeed or not, remained to be seen, was to export the problem. And they exported it to America and told people like William Penn, for instance, you see, who was a Quaker, and Quakerism was not acceptable in England. I mean, not respectable people weren't Quakers. It went against the law. Okay, well, you can't stay here and do this, but if you want, you know, to work out your particular ideas, we'll give you a tract of land in the wilderness on the other side of the Atlantic, and you can go off and do it there, which is, of course, what William Penn actually did, you see. And because the Quakers believed in tolerance, you know, the voice of the spirit speaking to the individuals, they created a colony which was had tolerance as its basic motto, really, you know. You could anyone could go there and settle there. And, of course, it became, because of that, a kind of refuge for people who weren't welcome anywhere else, you know, like the Amish and people like this. So gradually, you see, a kind of safety valve is opening up for people who have very different ideas, different perspectives. But the idea was, all right, you agree to disagree, but live and let live, you know, was the idea. And another case of this, the philosopher John Locke, who believed that it was possible to organize a society on the basis of reason, and was just itching to write a constitution for the ideal state, you know, that's what he wanted to do, was actually given the opportunity to do so, and in the foundation of the Carolinas, he wrote the constitution, beginning to establish a colony in which tolerance would rule. The idea was that different people with different points of view would be allowed to coexist, you see, in this. Gradually, you see, when it was discovered that neither Pennsylvania nor the Carolinas collapsed, you know, as a result of this, everything seemed to work reasonably well, the belief that tolerance might work gradually grew. You see that people would be allowed to do this. Holland was another country where tolerance became increasingly fashionable in the 17th century for different reasons. Holland was a small country. It was very easily divided. It was a country that lived by trade, so you had lots of people from different places turning up, and you couldn't really persecute them. You know, you were trying to do business with them. And so, of course, money talks, and gradually, again, tolerance becomes de facto, you know, the rule of society. As long as you don't tell anybody and you just go on and do what you want to do, you can get away with it, you see. And so it became a very sort of open-minded liberal society by the standards of that time, all right? Now, of course, when this happens, the trouble with tolerance is you've got to tolerate people you don't like. You've got to tolerate people you disagree with. And you've got to tolerate people who are wrong. You know, this is not an easy thing to do. I mean, people with wrong ideas have to be allowed to survive. You can't just pick and choose who you're going to tolerate. This is where the difficulty arose, because in 1695, the English government at that time abolished censorship. Up until that time, you couldn't publish a book in England unless it went through the censor first. And so a lot of you know, rubbish and so you know, pornography and things like that never got published, because the censor would just get rid of it. But remove censorship, and of course, what happens? All kinds of things that you know, would never have been published before suddenly appear, and in particular, criticisms of the church and its theology. This begins to appear, and very quickly, because only a year after the censorship was removed, a man called John Toland wrote a book called Christianity Not Mysterious, and published it. Now, John Tollard was only 26 years old at the time when he published this. His background was suspect, to put it mildly, because John Tollard had been born Roman Catholic and Irish to boot. But he had converted to Protestantism, which, of course, at that time made him a hero in England, you know, because he'd been rescued from the clutches of these evil priests and so on. However, the kind of Protestantism that Tollard had been converted to was essentially what we would call rationalism. And in Christianity Not Mysterious, Tollard sort of went through the Bible and basically said the whole thing is a lot of nonsense. You know, it talks about miracles. There are no miracles. There are contradictions here and there. There are all kinds of things that just don't add up. How can anyone believe this? Well, of course, this created a huge storm, protest. A law had to be passed against blasphemy because of what Tollard had written, you see. Tollard was never actually prosecuted for blasphemy, but it was a kind of warning, you know, that you can go too far in this sort of thing. But once the genie is out of the bottle, as it were, you know, once the door is open, it's extremely difficult to stop things like this. At more or less the same time, in France, the French Protestants were being expelled because King Louis XIV wanted a purely Catholic country. And so he told the Protestants, you can either convert to Catholicism, leave the country, or be killed. Well, quite a number, of course, converted to Catholicism. A few were killed, but an awful lot left the country. And those who left the country were extremely bitter. And, of course, they began to attack the Roman Catholic Church. And so the Roman Catholic Church is evil. Why is it evil? Because it believes in a whole lot of superstitious nonsense. Where does it get this superstitious nonsense from? Well, of course, from the traditions that it have been handed down, but also to some degree from the Bible. You know, it's not entirely tradition. And so these exiled French Protestants, in their bitterness towards, you know, the France and so on, and the Catholic Church for what they had happened, they were a ready target, if you like, for this kind of rationalistic discourse, because their basic argument was, you know, if you used common sense and if you based your state on reason, we would never have been thrown out. You know, we would have been allowed to stay because our faith is rational. Protestantism is rational, whereas Catholicism is not. So these people tie together Protestantism and rationalism as if they're more or less the same thing, and of course make rationalism true Protestantism. Now you might say to yourself, well, what about the Protestant churches, which, you know, didn't think that way? Well, that's true, but they dealt with them by saying, well, the trouble with the Protestant churches is they're not reformed enough. You know, they kicked out the Pope and they changed this and that and so on, but now they need to go further. You see, it's not enough just to reorganize the pews and have preachers instead of, you know, priests saying Mass and so on. You've got to go deeper than this and create an entirely rational religion. That's the spirit of Protestantism, is what they said. They claimed this, you see, for themselves. And they said the divisions which occur in Protestantism are there because different groups have gone different, you know, so far along the road, and they haven't all stopped in the same place. Whereas if they've followed the principle of rationalism to its logical conclusion, Protestants would all agree. You see, you'd be able to overcome denominational differences by clinging to what you might call today the lowest common denomination. You know, you just sort of agree on basic things that everybody's going to accept, that there's a creator God, and you know, there's morality and things like that, and then you won't have to worry about this superstructure. This is the things that divide us are not part of the essence of our faith. All right, even if they come from the Bible or are thought to come from the Bible. So this is the mentality. This is what's going around. You see, in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. Now, there were people, of course, who contradicted this. There were people who argued against it. But the mood of the time was very much in favor of this new rationalist push, what we today call the Enlightenment.
These courses provide a glimpse into our academic programs. Knox students can take 1 week or semester-length courses in person at our South Florida campus or choose to complete a degree entirely online. By bringing together academic excellence, a vibrant community of learning, and flexible scheduling, Knox offers today's students timeless truth through modern convenience. For more information about earning credit toward a master's degree, please visit our website at knoxseminary.edu.